You are now listening to the EU Startups Podcast.
Hello, and welcome to this episode of the EU Startups Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Dave Sennon-Garcia, the news editor here at EU Startups. Today, I had the honor of chatting with Fridjof. He's the co-founder and CBO of the VC Antler. Now, I imagine most of you know Antler. It's an incredibly active VC. I think so far they've invested in over 1,800 different investments. They provide different research data that's incredibly useful for us in the media. So it was a very interesting conversation. They've backed unicorns such as Lovable, Peak.ai. So they're incredibly relevant in the landscape we're operating today. In our chat, well, we covered everything from Antler's beginnings, their thesis when it comes to funding, the difference between different kinds of founders, whether it's geography or age, and even the impact of current socioeconomic, political advancements within the EU. Now I'm talking, of course, about EU Inc. I'm talking about the EU and India free trade agreement. All of these things impact the way funding flows in this ecosystem. And Fridjof had actually quite a bit to say on it. So I hope you're looking forward to that. But before that, a quick message from our sponsor, Vanta.
You're a startup founder. Finding product market fit is probably your number one priority. But to land bigger customers, you also need security compliance. And obtaining your SOC 2 or ISO 27001 certification can open those big doors. But they take time and energy, pulling you away from building and shipping. That's where Vanta comes in. Vanta is the all-in-one compliance solution, helping startups like yours get audit ready and build a strong security foundation quickly and painlessly. How? Vanta automates the manual security tasks that slow you down, helping you streamline your audit. And the platform connects you with trusted VC SOs to build your program, auditors to get you through audits quickly, and a marketplace for essentials like pen testing. So whether you're closing your first deal or gearing up for growth, Vanta makes compliance easy. Join over 8,000 companies, including many Y Combinator and Techstars startups, who trust Vanta. Simplify compliance and get $1,000 off at vanta.com/EU startups. That's vanta.com/EU startups.
Welcome, Fridjof, to the EU Startups Podcast. Thank you very much for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
No, it's our pleasure. So I was hoping that before we get started, you could just present yourself, the background of Antler, maybe how it began, and then we can get into the real meat of the interview.
Sounds fantastic. I'm the co-founder and chief business officer at Antler. Antler is an early stage venture capital investor investing all around the globe. And typically we refer to what we do as kind of inception stage investing, because we go in systematically in companies around the world from the really early stages. You can call it almost like an early pre-seed round, inception stage round, the first capital coming into companies. And we do this all around the world, started in Singapore in 2018 with the first couple of investments. Have since scaled across Europe, the US, APAC, Africa, Middle East, South America now. So we're in 22 countries and in 27 cities. We're running these same type of investment processes. Mm-hmm. And it's made us, at least according to several different rankings, the most active early stage investor in terms of volume of deals. Obviously, we start with small check sizes initially, but that's made us very, very active, this approach. And on top of that, we, of course, follow on, similar to other venture capital companies, as they continue to develop. But this going broad initially phase or strategy, if you like, has been at the core of what we've been doing since 2018, because we've been seeing that more and more people want to start companies. They can start faster, they can do more with less. So I think that building relationships and adding value to companies from an early stage is perhaps more important now than ever in a market that is rapidly changing. So gives you a bit of context on Antler. And then of course, through my role, it's taken me in many different directions building this company together with tremendous co-founders and colleagues. But excited to unwrap and share more.
Well, you don't really need to tell me you're very active, because I think we receive a press release from Antler at least every day, if not multiple day, on a wide variety of things. And we'll get into the different kind of research you do, which is also very valuable to us in the media. But even apart from just the startup site maybe you're supporting, there's great research that kind of gives a great snapshot into how things are evolving here in Europe, whether it's founders, whether it's funding, whether it's even just a ratio of women founders, you know, versus men. That all that kind of data is very useful to us, and you are very present, I think, in all of us here. So, with that in mind, I guess I kind of want to touch on you personally, and just to go back, because I know you've had experience in McKinsey, Nordic Footwear, I believe I saw, and then you had your own med tech startup beforehand. And I was curious just how that kind of formation informs the way you engage with founders and startups now.
Yes, so maybe I'll divide it into a bit of just personal habits, strengths, if you like, and then of course your professional experience. I think both of those combined led me to eventually co-found Antler. So if I think about the personal side, I've always been very intellectually curious. It's fun to learn new things, and it's fun to be around people where you can learn fast. And I've always been comfortable having a lot of different projects going on at the same time. It's always a bit of a trade-off, right? With some people really wanting to only focus on one thing, and others are quite fine doing a lot of things. And of course, there's a trade-off in time you can spend on each thing. But I've always enjoyed having a lot of things going on. So of course, when you think about Antler, it's a lot of things going on, as you've mentioned, and there's a lot of people teaching you new things. So I think that kind of personal interest of mine made it a very natural fit to eventually develop what became Antler. Now, professionally, you mentioned a few different things. And of course, most of my career prior to Antler was in McKinsey. And I think that what's great there is you learn to be thorough. You learn also to be, to some extent, uncomfortably ambitious. You set very aggressive timelines for yourself, for the clients, what you want to achieve. And then you sort of work your way backwards, figuring out how can we achieve this, or at least get close to achieving this. That type of way of thinking is very useful in the startup world. You want to set, you know, I wouldn't call them unrealistic targets. They should always be theoretically possible, but you should set very ambitious targets and then try to get to that stage, or at least as close to that as possible, because then you will at least get farther than if you have a smaller target. So that's been very much the mindset in Antler from the beginning of our journey. And it's very much part of the kind of mindset we try to push founders to have. Of course, the great ones, I think they have that in themselves, but it's important to emphasize that when we're working with them. So in terms of my background coming into Antler, I think that's kind of how my personal and professional experience links in. Maybe the final thing I'll say is I've been, you know, I'm from Norway. I've been growing up there and then studied in the UK and the US. Live now out of Singapore for what's becoming soon 9 years. So it's a quite global background, a lot of experience working in different ecosystems. And I think what's exciting is you always learn and pick up something from each ecosystem, but you also learn that founders in general are, I think, more similar than they are different in all of these different ecosystems. And they're of course battling different challenges depending on what kind of company they build and where they build it. But it's great to see that, you know, great people want to make a difference. They share a lot of the same characteristics.
Oh, and that is interesting. And maybe before we get into all that, because there's a lot of good data you've provided that I kind of want to dive into there. I'm curious because we've at Ustarps have followed Antler since, I mean, as early back as we can really. You know, from you deploying $5.4 million across 44 startups, 2019, the Nordic Fund a few years later. So I'm curious, at each stage of this kind of growth that Antler went through, how would you say your role within it adapted? Because I think it's similar to even a startup journey where maybe you begin very early stage pre-seed, but then as the company grows and becomes more successful, the CEO, co-founder role eventually adapts. And I was curious if you had any kind of insight into the way that impacted you.
It's definitely changed. And I'll probably mention kind of three fairly distinct phases. Before that, maybe summarize quickly because you started off there, and thanks for following since the beginning. You're right, you know, in 2018, we were even smaller than the numbers you mentioned from 2019. We just made, I believe it was 13 investments in 2018. Then, of course, a bit more in 2019. And fast forwarding to now, it's more than 400 new investments happening around the world. Mm-hmm. Of course, it's a very high number, but at the same time, it's 27 cities, you know, comprising this number. So it is very manageable for the teams on the ground. But collectively, of course, it's a whole different scale. And sure. I think throughout that, it's been, as I mentioned, three phases. Initially, it was, you know, everyone sitting in the same room in Singapore. We had a whiteboard and, you know, you write down all the tasks and people just grab 5 or 10 of them and you just get them done, right? Finding the next office, buying a corporate stamp, you know, because you need stamps on different documents in different countries. Sure. Going out, meeting founders, grabbing coffees, talking to the bank, you know, getting a bank account. So all of these really early things, it's quite exciting. And it's fond memories looking back because everyone is just running in the same direction, but we're also small enough to know everything and mm-hmm. be part of everything. So I will say that first year, of course, it evolved a lot over that first year, but that's kind of how I look at the first year, as everyone just trying to get us going, finding founders, getting some investors in, making the first investments. And at that stage, it's really about shaping the core value proposition of Antler, figuring out how we can be helpful to founders, validating the idea, essentially. Then from, I will say, kind of the next 4 to 5 years, maybe you can call it building the machine in some way. It was really about now replicating what we had proven, at least to ourselves in Singapore. We wanted to prove this in other markets. And I traveled a lot during that time to different cities, trying to bring in great partners to build in that location, show them the playbook, figure out how we needed to adapt to the local ecosystem. One example of that can be, in some markets, you know, you don't use LinkedIn as much to reach great people. You use maybe other channels. The language, the marketing, the competitive environment needs to be adapted. But you do sort of a mix of localization and replicating the playbook. This was, of course, very operationally intense from the internal perspective, meaning that I was focused a lot on how do we create an effective organization. Then the last phase is really kind of the last, I guess, 3-4 years now, it's been more externally focused for me, because with this scale, you get a lot of economies of scale and you get a lot of network effects. But most importantly, you become an interesting collaborator for governments, corporations, and other, you know, investors and players in the startup ecosystem. So you can work on projects together. You can create new value propositions to founders. So a couple of things that can illustrate this is easier ways to get visas into a new market by collaborating with the government for new entrepreneurs. It can be volume discounts with cloud providers for our companies, because we sort of negotiate on behalf of a lot of them. So my mindset has shifted more to the external environment the last few years. I think that's an exciting external frame to put on things. Sure. And that's kind of the third phase. But throughout all of that, I try to stay close to coaching founders and be in a number of the investment committees. But of course, you need to be quite efficient with your time. And of course, we need to divide and conquer as any startup does.
Well, you're talking here externally, you know, and that kind of starts to make me think globally, because you mentioned Singapore, you're active across Europe. It makes me think about if you have any kind of outlook as to how founders, startups change in respect to these different ecosystems, if there's kind of an approach you have to address, maybe if it's about risk taking, that there's kind of maybe a different way of looking at things when you're talking about companies and individuals who are based in Berlin versus Singapore.
Yeah, I think it's a great broader topic, right? So maybe a good place to start is, as mentioned in this report you brought up in the beginning, right? Like founders are building unicorn companies out of more and more places. Luckily for this audience, more and more in Europe as well, right? So very, very exciting to see. And you see Berlin, as you mentioned, an example of a place really having a lot of activity at the moment. So coming from, it's now 12, 13 years ago, it was only around 30 cities that had unicorns. Now it's well over 300, right? So very big change. What does that mean? It's coming from many reasons. Of course, the access to capital, access to talent, the internet has brought distribution to a whole different level. So it's become easier. Now, what's also become easier is the choice for founders of where they build, right? So of course it's tied to your passport as well, but let's say you're in Europe, you can go and build in many different places in the EU. You can also go to places that have quite visa friendly setups, a number of places in the Middle East, Singapore, another example where founders can come in and build fairly easily. So suddenly you have not just sort of the choice of who do you want to hire? Where do you want to use your office? How do you want to spend your money? But also, where do I want to build? And again, like I think like people-wise, founders are fairly similar around the world. But of course, the pros and cons differ greatly in each market. So I think Europe and EU sometimes are getting a bit of a hard time in the press when people compare to China and the US in terms of some of the success stories. But it's you know, quite a lot of movement of people, for example. Maybe on the downsides, you of course have a trickier way of upscaling and then downscaling your employment workforce compared to, let's say, in the US. But again, you have more security for people who want to maybe join startups. So, you know, everything is consisting of pros and cons. What I will say is the products and the services people provide are... especially in this kind of AI-driven startup environment we're living in now, they can be executed quite easily in one location and then distributed across the globe fairly easily. It's kind of small barriers to entry new markets. And of course, the cost of a lot of things keep on going down. I think this is in general good for Europe because you can start companies now with fairly low amounts of capital and prove more with the same amount of capital than you could before, meaning you can come to you know, higher valuations and get more money in exchange for less of your company at a later stage to further fuel growth. Sure. What perhaps 10 years ago was the case is you need these kind of mega rounds already from A and B, and then it's really hard to then compete with the US. So it's still early, rapidly developing, but I think that the change to even more than before lowering the barrier to entry for great entrepreneurs can be beneficial to Europe.
Okay. Yeah. And I guess for our listeners, the report we keep referencing is that Anatomy of Greatness, which is a great name, by the way. It's very catchy. I don't know who chose it, but it sticks with you. This comparison with, as you've said, China, as you've said, the US, it's incredibly relevant right now. Just within your report, I think I saw that while the U.S. is dominant, their share has fallen in comparison over the decade-long span that the report looks at. And I'm curious to hear your thoughts on kind of, because recently there's kind of been some big socioeconomic, political advancements when we're talking about the EU. There's the proposal of EU Inc., which I actually spoke about just, I think, with the previous interview, because it keeps popping up because it's incredibly relevant. There's the EU-India trade agreement. And I'm curious how Antler is seeing this kind of change. How is it impacting your plans for the future? You know, if we talk about EU-India, we're talking about maybe startups now have easier access to the EU market opening them up to a new customer base, and vice versa, right? EU startups maybe now have access to a larger market they didn't before. Is this kind of playing into the way you're going to see Antler evolve?
I'm not sure how much it will play into how we evolve, but it's very important, of course, for any company doing almost anything, right? unless you're an extremely local business, geopolitics will be at the, big portion of what you need to spend time understanding. The reason why I maybe said it wouldn't impact the direction for Antler too much is we are, of course, already very globally distributed, and we are in a number of the world's biggest markets, nearly all of them. And I think we do want to try to be as many places as we can where we see it's feasible to support startups. Now, just some commentary on what you said. There's all of these trade deals and a lot of different discussions happening between big countries and, of course, coalitions of smaller countries. What I think we've seen over the last few years is things are not maybe as black and white as before. It's not as simple as saying I'm going to build with the Chinese tech stack or the American tech stack, and that's going to determine my direction. I think the cycles of how things change will be shorter and shorter. You see this with, of course, all the AI rankings. 1 week it's the new Gemini model leading, and then maybe there's an open source model from China taking the lead the next week. So it's hard to know how things will play out. And of course, startups need to be selfish and figure out how do they get the best enablers of their product or service. And that can change a lot. So it's less black and white than before. And you see that as a result of that, countries or regions like EU and India, you mentioned, are thinking more and more about various different trade deals and maybe not just relying on one or two big collaborations. So as a startup, I would think about kind of many plans. Maybe I have a plan A, B, C, or target A, B, C, and understand that in this environment we live in where things happen very fast, the news cycles are very quick, you just need to be comfortable with uncertainty, but also perhaps not lock yourself too quickly into just one strategy and disregard the rest, because we see the world is constantly evolving.
Yeah, well, on that topic of that constantly evolution, the fast moving ecosystem, one point of data really jumped out to me was that there was that unicorn creation jumped from around 4 a year a decade ago to nearly 150 today, which is that's a huge number. When you see that, what does that tell you? I mean, does that excite you? Does it maybe worry you that we're moving too fast?
I think it excites me much more than it worries me. It means, of course, that you can create something very valuable if you're a group of smart people working hard, creating good product market fit. That's incredible. And coupled with the earlier data point around, more than 300 cities, it also means you can be in Vietnam, in India, in Norway, anywhere, and you can have at least a fighting chance to create something amazing, changing, of course, people's lives along the way and creating local and global value creation. So that is exciting. Then, of course, as an investor, you should always be a little bit concerned with how much is hype, how much is, FOMO, fear of missing out, and people kind of pushing valuations up very rapidly because they just want to get in at all costs. So as an investor, of course, you need to be very diligent about how you spend your dollars. But at the same time, the reason why that fear is not outshining the potential and the positive signs is because a lot of the unicorns you see now, for example, have true traction, right? Like they have revenue, they have customers, they have people building great things with their products. Lovable is a portfolio company of Antler. It's mentioned a lot probably in your podcast as well with one of the recent success stories out of Sweden. There's people there building real businesses using Lovable, right? And that's great to see. So that's perhaps one reason that there seems to be things under the hood, to use a simple analogy, that makes me optimistic on behalf of the unicorns coming out now. And then, of course, just to sort of adjust the expectations a little bit, if you can say, it's of course different to have been a unicorn 10, 12 years ago versus now, because of course $1 billion company now is less valuable than 12 years ago. I wouldn't say that that's, of course, the majority of the reason for that big increase, but it does factor in a little bit that, of course, $1 billion company now is a little bit different than $1 billion company 12 years ago.
I think that naturally leads into also the age differentiation, because that was also another data point on how it seems that AI, specifically unicorn founders, seem to be getting younger. I think if I saw it right, it dropped to 29 on average in 2024. So when you're meeting these kind of younger founders, is there a generational difference that is adding to this kind of that they're younger and that they're getting these ideas and getting this traction earlier? Is there kind of a shift that you've seen that maybe highlights that difference?
I think it was one of the most interesting things we saw in this report. I know it's been mentioned a few times, but we tried to map all the unicorns from 2014 to 2024. And not just the unicorns, but really 19 different characteristics on the co-founders or founder behind the companies. And as you mentioned, what we saw is for the companies labeled as primarily an AI company, the age of the founders had gone down fairly significantly. And I think that you... let me rephrase. So you get a lot of benefit now in the AI world of being very good at constantly iterating, moving fast, and being very comfortable with the cutting edge technology. Mm-hmm. Of course, having good networks, having experience, those are not negatives, but I think they matter perhaps a little bit less in this environment, where if you can use the latest tools, if you can constantly iterate, if you can be, again, uncomfortably ambitious, you can constantly be relevant and build a highly capable product. So I think that that perhaps favors even younger founders more so than the older environment. You've always seen outliers throughout history. Bill Gates was, of course, very young. Elon Musk was very young when they started building their great companies. But that is one sort of theory we have on why you're seeing a bit earlier or AI founders being a bit younger. I think that that probably will continue. I'm not saying that it means older founders have no chance. Of course they do. But you need to be very willing to constantly iterate. And of course, for these founders to be very comfortable using the latest and greatest tools and technologies that are out there.
Okay. Well, we've kind of covered such a wide span of the funding sector. I'm very happy for it, because that was the main thing I wanted to tackle here. So I guess for the final question here, and then I'll let you go. But I wanted to kind of look ahead and maybe look ahead to the challenges that you see in the sector that you're operating in daily. You know, we mentioned the women to men ratio. And if I had the stats right here, it was that female unicorn founders have increased sixfold, but still only represent 6% of all founders. So it's kind of like a double-edged sword, a kiss and a slap a little bit, because it's good news, right? But it's still such a long ways to go. So when you're looking at data like that, what are the main challenges you're foreseeing in the coming 5-10 years?
I think on that challenge, you summarized it well. Like, things are going in the right direction, but it's far from, I think, where it should be. Hopefully, with the barriers in terms of cost and networks further going down, I think entrepreneurship for great people will be even more accessible. And hopefully that can play a part in improving that figure. Hopefully so, because again, it's a big you know, big challenge ahead there. I think on the broader challenges for, I guess, our world, the world of venture, backing great people, it is to make sure that you're always finding ways to be relevant to founders. Mm-hmm. So what's going on now, you know? You can do a lot more with less. You can get access to so much good advice and access so many markets fairly easily if you have a good product market fit. Now, you still need to, if you want to open up offices in different places, go abroad. Even though the cost of starting has gone down, you still need to raise probably some considerable capital at some stage to really create rapid scaling. And of course, you want to spend every dollar the smartest way. So there are things you still need to overcome as a founder, whether you have a good product or not. Can venture capitalists or other players in the ecosystem be helpful with that? Is of course an important question to ask. And from the Antler side, that's kind of playing a little bit into what we've been trying to build over the last few years. We've been trying to build a kind of global platform because founders in Singapore, if they want to access the US market, they can leverage our team, our office, our network. If they want to raise funding from, let's say, healthcare investors, we know majority of healthcare investors, not just in Asia, but also across Europe and the US. And of course, if they want to get good deals with corporations providing products and services, we can help them do sort of a group deal on those things to use their dollars in a better way. So for us, at least, we have a clear strategy for how to continue to add value to companies beyond just the capital and investment. Mm-hmm. And I think that investors in today's market need to think about that, right? So how can you stay relevant beyond just the capital? Because capital can come in many forms, in many ways, from many areas. But providing value in other ways as well to great founders will be important to get their attention and be part of their journeys.
Okay. Well, we at U-Startups will definitely keep an eye out. We've been paying attention since the beginning and hopefully for a long time from now. And I want to thank you, Frijo, for coming on the podcast. It's been a pleasure. Hopefully we'll run into each other. I think we were both at VDS last year on stage, just a different occasion.
Yes, yes, I was there. It was a great event and hope to be back later this year. So
yes,
hope always happy to come on again and thanks for having me.
No, thank you, Frijo. Bye.
Take care.